May it please the court, counsel. My name is Peter Bornstein, and I represented the plaintiffs below. My bar number is 4883. I represented the plaintiffs below. I represent the appellants here. I intend to reserve 3 minutes or so for rebuttal, if I might. And I didn't quite understand how the clock worked, but I'll try to make sure that I don't go over so I lose my rebuttal.
Okay, well, that is your responsibility to reserve time for rebuttal, but we'll try to help you out if we can.
I'd like to use my time on oral argument to discuss three subjects. The first subject is the Montage Project joint venture, believing that Mr. Judd was acting as its lawyer, and therefore there was a lawyer-client relationship. The second subject is that, assuming that this court finds that the trial court was wrong to grant summary judgment on Montage Project joint venture, and that Judd was not the lawyer for Cedar Street, the other one of the joint venture partners, how does the duty of loyalty apply to a party that is a partner but not a client of the lawyer? And the third issue, if I have, is to deal with the issue of how the statute of limitations can possibly run against an entity before both the principals of that entity or the lawyer for that entity knew that the entity relationship existed, instead of what the parties acted under, which was a purchaser and sale relationship, or a debtor and a lender relationship. At core, this case is about the damages a lawyer can cause when he or she takes on dual representation. And that is what this case is really about, is it's a dual representation case. The evidence established on summary judgment before the trial court was that Mr. Judd took on the representation of both one partner, M&M, and the entity, the Montage Project Joint Venture. And as we set forth in our brief, this was not, as the court in the Turkey Creek versus Rosania case said, benefits may have accrued to the joint venture, such benefit was incidental. And in that case, they talked about why there was no relationship with the joint venture, because the legal consequences that were explained and dealt with for all four principals in this case was absent in that case. And as we set forth in our brief, there was a large body of fact and work done by Mr. Judd on behalf of the whole project. First of all, he conceived it, he changed the conception of it, and he convinced the principals to change their concept that one party was going to be investing in a limited liability company while the other one was going to be managing it and running it. Instead, he created what was later called a tax dodge or a tax scheme that didn't work, which was to recast this as a purchase and sale agreement. Ultimately, it was determined that that was, number one, not correct, and number two, mischaracterized the entire way this should have been done from the beginning.
Counsel, can you explain why the September 29th of 2005 letter from Mr. Judd acting on behalf of M&M to Cedar Street regarding default under the purchase and sale agreement, why wouldn't that letter have put Cedar Street and its principal, Mr. Raymond, on notice that Mr. Judd was not acting for Cedar Street, but was in fact representing M&amp;M's interests.
That question gets to the heart of the dispute that should have been resolved at the trial court. And that is that it's correct. Mr. Judd never claimed that he was acting for Cedar Street. And in our appeal and in our position below, we never claimed that Mr. Judd was acting for Cedar Street. If you think of this as a three-legged stool, two sets of partners and an entity, we did not claim that the Cedar Street group had a lawyer-client relationship with Mr. Judd. So when he wrote that letter to Cedar Street, and he wrote all these letters, lots of letters to Cedar Street, you're in default. If you don't do X, Y, and Z, we're going to take the property away from you. We're going to exercise this and that right under the purchase and sale agreement. Those were not notices regarding his relationship with the joint venture. However, they were all breaches of his duty of loyalty to the joint venture, assuming that the trial court would find, or that this court would find on appeal, that there was a lawyer-client relationship established with the joint venture. And when he sent that September letter, he was, obviously we're not saying that Cedar Street didn't know, I mean they knew obviously that he was working against them. But he did not say, I'm working against the partnership, because at that point all the parties believed that they had a different form of relationship.
Well, then answer this. I mean, why does the characterization of the entity of the Montage Project, whether you call it a partnership or whether you call it a joint venture, why does that have any particular legal significance when the facts, when the parties were aware of what was happening and who was doing what for whom?
Well, they weren't aware. Not at that point. It's like let me put it this way, if Mr. Raymond were to be held to a higher standard than Mr. Judd, that wouldn't make any sense, intuitive or otherwise, because Mr. Judd is a lawyer and he should know what dual representation is and how a lawyer can get involved in representing both the entity and one of the partners. But if Mr. Judd knew that there was a partnership, and he acted as though it didn't exist, and he advocated all the way through the arbitration that it didn't exist, he has one kind of breach of fiduciary duty problem. On the other hand, if he didn't know that this existed, and that's what we're saying occurred during that period of time in 2005, if he didn't know that this joint venture partnership situation existed, and until he lost the case, and he did lose the case, then he can't have a lesser standard of knowledge than Mr. Raymond. Mr. Raymond can't be charged with acting against either Mr. Judd earlier on the statute of limitations issue based on a level of knowledge that is higher than this attorney.
Okay. That would be legal knowledge, but I mean the facts are is that the attorney wasn't working in Cedar Street's interest. And so if you're trying to distinguish between the legal theory and factual for the statute of limitations purpose, how could they have not known?
See, what Cedar Street knew was that its partners had turned on it. Cedar Street knew that its partners had turned on it, and that's not the... That's the issue before this court, is that we say, and the issue on this appeal, that the fact that Cedar Street knew that the partners had turned on it and they were in an adversarial position only deals with two legs of the three-legged stool. And if we ignore, which is what the appellee's brief does, and what your questions focus solely on what Cedar Street knew, if we focus on that, only what Cedar Street knew and when Cedar Street knew it, then their argument has credence. And That's the mistake that I believe that the trial court made, was to focus only on Cedar Street and what Cedar Street knew and when Cedar Street knew it. I'm trying to ask this court to focus on the entity, the project, and when it was charged with knowledge, or when its principals were charged with knowledge, number one, that Mr. Judd actually was acting on behalf of the entity. Number two, that by his conduct and the conduct that occurred back in the original 6 or 8 months of setting this up and assembling the property and transferring the property from Mr. Osborne and Mr. Raymond to Mr. Moreland and Mr. Mnuchin, that during that period of time, Mr. Judd, by his actions, and as Turkey Creek versus Rosania says, it doesn't have to be an express agreement. If the relationship is established by the conduct of the parties, and we are saying that by the conduct of Mr. Judd and the parties, they established his attorney-client relationship with the entity. But you're right, if you focus only on Cedar Street, their argument has credence. And so my job at oral argument, and hopefully my job at the brief, was to focus the attention of this court on the entity.
Counsel, when the arbiter issued his, I don't know if it was the his or her, but issued a decision concerning the legal effect of the site agreement vis-a-vis the purchase and sale agreement, did the arbiter have to decide what kind of entity this was? And if so, why?
Yes, because the issue was, did the partners have a fiduciary relationship to Cedar Street? That was in the arbitration. Did they violate their fiduciary duty to Cedar Street? And in order to say that they violated their fiduciary duty to Cedar Street, they had to be first determined that the fiduciary duty existed as one partner to another. That's the answer is yes. I believe I have 2 minutes and 44 seconds left. Is that how
just,
I read this?
Yeah, just under 3 minutes. So
I would rather answer questions of the court than reserve rebuttal, but if I, well, otherwise I'd reserve some rebuttal.
You can reserve a rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Bornstein.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Palmieri, registration number 14252, along with my co-counsel, Heather Kelly. I'm proud to represent Richard Judd and Robinson Watterson Adorsio. For the record, Mr. Judd is also present. The case is before the court on summary judgment on two separate motions. The first motion addressed the attorney-client relationship, which is a threshold issue with respect to the duty arguments that Mr. Bornstein has made, in which the trial judge, Judge Ann Frick, found no evidence of an attorney-client relationship. And in a second motion directed to the statute of limitations issue, in which the court addressed, just as Judge Fox had highlighted, the default letters and the other information that was available to everyone back in September of 2005, if not earlier, and even some additional information later, in which the court, trial court, found that triggered the statute of limitations, which expired, whether it would be a 2-year statute of limitations for intentional interference or negligence, or a 3-year statute of limitations on breach of fiduciary duty. I'd like to briefly address the attorney-client issue and then also address the statute of limitation issue. In so doing, I want to address the three points that Mr. Bornstein had raised. The first, talking about the subjective belief issue, which is a threshold issue on the attorney-client relationship. As Mr. Bornstein noted, you can have an express or implied contractual relationship between attorney and client, but it's a contractual relationship. It requires a contract, it requires a meeting of the minds. As the Turkey Creek case discusses, when you're looking at the partnership issues, you have to establish that contractual relationship between the attorney and the client. As in the Turkey Creek case, even if there's this now testimony that there was a subjective belief by one of the principals of one of the joint venturers, that's just a factor to consider. So when you look at this, I disagree with Mr. Bornstein's characterization of this as a three-legged stool. To the extent that there was, and it's subject to dispute whether there was a Montage Project joint venture, but as found, the arbiter was Judge Matt Rayling, as found there, the relationship would be more in a triangle, that you would have at the foundation Moreland and Manoogian on the one hand, Cedar Street on the other, and then those two entities are the members of the Montage Project.
Now, what's your position with regard to whether the arbiter had to conclude what kind of entity this was to give legal effect to the site agreement?
Our position is he did not have to. That, in fact, really, in essence, even the arbiter's finding did not change substantively the agreement between or among the parties. And, in fact, Leslie Teffer, who is one of the attorneys for Cedar Street, testified in this case that even from her perspective, she really didn't see this as a joint venture, that instead it was more purchase and sale. But setting that aside, the arbiter went forward and found that because I think that in finding that, he addressed some of the relationships and he found some remedies. But it doesn't change the fundamental issue here, which is Mr. Judd represented Moreland Manoogian, Leslie Teffer represented Cedar Street. There is no evidence that either of them, in particular Mr. Judd, ever represented the Montage Project joint venture.
Now, if we conclude that, in fact, the statute of limitations for either claim has run, do we even need to reach the attorney-client issue?
You do not, Judge Fox. And I think that the evidence is significant on the attorney-client relationship issue, and I think Judge Frick's finding there is solid, rock solid on the lack of evidence. But the statute of limitations is overwhelming. When you look at the relationship here, and you look at the facts, the only thing that we hear from the appellee is, how could Mr. Raymond know? We have an attorney, Mr. Judd, and he would understand some of these relationships. How on earth could Mr. Raymond possibly know or understand these relationships? Because he had counsel. He was represented through Cedar Street by Leslie Teffer in connection with the deal. When the dispute arose in the summer of 2005, Teffer was the one who contacted Judd. That was the initial contact in July of 2005. Teffer then reports back to Cedar Street saying they don't want to close, there are disputes. So then to walk this forward, Mr. Raymond had another lawyer, Marcus Square Up, who represented him individually in his dispute with Eric Osborne. So not only do you have the disputes between Moreland Manoogian and Cedar Street, you have the internal dispute within Cedar Street between Mr. Osborne and Mr. Raymond. Each had separate counsel. By the time you get to the arbitration proceedings, Cedar Street then is represented by counsel again, Timothy Rostello at Holland and Hart. So throughout this process, throughout this procedure, Cedar Street, Mr. Raymond had access to legal counsel at each and every step. So when you look at the statute of limitations and when you hear the argument that, well, you know, who'd have thunk it? How would you know? You had legal counsel at each and every step of this. And when you have four default letters, not just the first default letter in September of 2005, but no less than four default letters that go out saying, we are taking the position adverse to you. When you have the disputes between Raymond and Osborne themselves, when you have the dispute with Cedar Street that goes to arbitration, you can't have any stronger evidence of a dispute. So then the argument comes back, well, but how would we know that we had an injury unless or until we got the arbitration award? In two ways that are completely obvious and undisputed. First and foremost, the receiver was appointed. The project came to a screeching halt in 2005. That you have the default letter from Judd to Cedar Street. You have the receivership litigation then between Osborne and Raymond, and the project comes to a screeching halt. What better or clearer evidence can you have that there was some type of injury to the project? Now we're talking the project, not just Cedar Street, not just Moreland Manoogian. The project stopped.
Excuse me, but right there, when the receiver was appointed, was the receivership for the Montage
project?
It was for Cedar Street. The receiver was appointed for Cedar Street, but in fact was dealing with the project.
Because at that time, we didn't know there was a Montage Project joint venture. Is that right?
The receiver wasn't appointed for such. But again, to the extent that the project is an entity or exists, it stopped. In addition, the other injury that you have is the attorney's fees. And as the cases have held, if you incur attorney's fees to ameliorate a problem, that is sufficient injury to trigger the statute of limitations.
What about, how do you respond to your opponent's suggestion in the briefing that somehow Mr. Judge was hiding behind this Tamsin entity that later ended up taking over the loan?
Well, I think just the opposite. Not that he was hiding behind or not, but again, it's additional evidence that showed the disputes among the parties. The fact is, at that point in time, Mr. Raymond and Cedar Street were represented by counsel. Mr. Judd was representing Moreland Manoogian, and everyone knew that Mr. Judd was also representing Tamsin. In fact, this even goes to the interference with contract issue, because when Tamsin acquired the American National Bank note, everybody knew that. And in fact, that's the allegation that is what the interference with contract was. So the fact that Mr. Judd was hesitant to disclose the principles of Tamsin doesn't affect the knowledge that Mr. Raymond Cedar Street and the project, Montage Project Joint Venture had. Everyone knew that Tamsin had acquired the note. Who the principals were of Tamsin was of no import. Everyone knew that Judd was representing both, and it came clear. I mean, all you had to do was check with the Secretary of State.
Was Tamsin an entity that would have had to register with the Secretary of State's office?
Yes. So just to go back briefly through the attorney-client relationship, I understand it's not necessary to address that. If you affirm on the statute of limitations, it's there. But when you look at the findings by Judge Frick, she just addresses each and every argument, each and every issue that is present there. And it is strikingly similar to the Turkey Creek. And let me just highlight a couple of issues there. Number one, in Turkey Creek, the lawyers there performed title work. And the argument was, well, the title work was for the benefit of Miller, who was the outsider, for lack of a better term. And the Court of Appeals there addressed and said, no, doing the title work actually provided a benefit to Goldfields, the attorney's client. We have the same thing here with the American National Bank relationship. In addition, in the Turkey Creek, they argued about whether they had paid the attorney's fees. And again, here, Judge Frick recognized that it's very common that when you have a borrower-lender relationship, lender has the money and borrower is going to pay those attorney's fees. So there's a solid, rock-solid basis there for Judge Frick. Similarly, on the statute of limitations, we've talked about the knowledge, when you look at the default letters, when you look at the litigation, when you have the fact that at each and every step, Raymond or Cedar Street or the project have access to legal counsel, there's nothing hidden here. This is why you have statutes of limitations. If you have not just lawyers who are on retainer, but competent legal counsel involved in litigation, you can't have stronger facts. In terms of the injury, we talked about the receiver, it shut the project down, and we talked about the attorney's fees to ameliorate it. An argument was on the Doyle case. I'd like to briefly distinguish Doyle. It's an older case. There was a trespass case, and they said, well, until you had a decision on the trespass, you didn't have an injury. Well, there, because you were in possession of the property. So you have the property, you don't have an injury. But when you lose that property, you can have an injury. Not the same as we have here. You have a receivership, that shut the project down. You have the attorney's fees. Moreover, Doyle was older. It was the old 6-year statute of limitations, and arguably has been overruled. Well, we couldn't wait. We had to wait until the arbitration decision came down. It's the next argument. But when you look in the legal malpractice arena,
at a series of cases in the criminal context, but they're instructive. They talk about Rule 35 and post-conviction relief. They said, well, we argue ineffective assistance of counsel, but we don't want to sue the lawyer until the court determines that there's ineffective assistance, because if not, we're going to have to undermine our position. The Morrison versus Goff case says, no, nope, the statute runs. Rance v. Kaufman and the Truman case. We cite those at page 40 of our brief. In summary, the statute of limitations on the attorney-client relationship was well-founded. It should be affirmed based upon the standards set forth in our paper and the argument. On the statute of limitations issue, the undisputed evidence is overwhelming. You have each and every element here. There's no basis for equitable tolling. These are sophisticated business people in big-time litigation with big-time lawyers, and there's simply no reason to have anything tolled here. For those reasons, we ask that the court affirm on the statute of limitations and on the attorney-client relationship. If you have no questions, I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Fox, let me address the statute of limitations issue as it's been raised, or as you have raised it. Going back to the Maestro case, the Maestro case says the statute of limitations begins to run when the claimant has knowledge of facts which would put a reasonable person on notice of the nature and extent of an injury, and that the injury was caused by the wrongful conduct of another. The three criminal law cases that counsel cites are obvious that the defendant knows that he lost the case. He's been convicted. So he knows that he's been injured, and he blames his lawyer for doing it, but he wants to wait to see if perhaps the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, overturns it, then his case goes away. In that context, it makes sense in why you would have to file your suit and then ask the court to stay it in the civil arena. In this context, it doesn't make sense. And the reason it doesn't make sense is that our case is about knowledge and the existence of the conflict of interest based on dual representation. Now, it's my position that in order to find under the statute of limitations, this court would have to do fact-finding on appeal. It would have to make fact-finding about what Marcus Squirrel or Holland and Hart knew, or why they would have counsel Mr. Raymond about, by the way, you know, we're fighting Mr. Osborne, we're fighting M&M, we're trying to establish that there's a fiduciary relationship. Oh, by the way, there might also be a claim here against the attorney because of a conflict of interest with an entity. That would have to revolve. It's not in the record. You would have to do fact finding. It's going outside the record.
Counsel, but we do have in the record that in fact, you know, once the note was purchased, they stopped making advances. And correct. So wouldn't that have put Cedar Street and Mr. Raymond on notice that in fact, Mr. Judge was not acting on their behalf? And
again, Cedar Street is on notice. I am conceding that point. Cedar Street and Mr. Raymond knew that Mr. Judd was an advocate against his position and his interest vis-a-vis Cedar Street. What he didn't know was that there was a conflict of interest and that the claim belongs not to Cedar Street, because he knows, and any lawyer would tell him, you can't sue your adversary. You can't sue the lawyer for your adversary. That's basic malpractice law. So if you went to Squirrel, if you went to Holland and Hart, they would say, you don't have a case. You can't sue the lawyer for your adversary. It requires the first fact-finding, which is something that we think the jury ought to do, that there was, in fact, an entity, and that Judd, in fact, took on the lawyer relationship on the entity far beyond Goldfields and the Rosania case.
Okay, Mr. Borstein, you're out of time. Thank you very much for your arguments. Thanks to both counsel. These were very helpful arguments. We really appreciate your being here today. This case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That's the final.